Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
I mean, what's that football focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFF.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
You just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam. So, who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football season, all the things that go with it.
Welcome into the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Palazzolo, Sam Monson. We are here to recap most things. Week 5 in the NFL. Still maybe 2 games to go, Sam. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. I'm better because your intro is back the way it should be. And that makes everything all right with the world again.
We're seeing the numbers go up, too. Maybe it's linked to the...
The second you did that, I think it's true.
It's linked to the intro, perhaps.
Yeah.
Before we get into it, just want to tell you guys about an amazing offer from our friends over at Monkey Knife Fight. Just do the math on this one. All first-time depositors at Monkey Knife Fight that put at least $20 into their account while using the promo code PFF will receive a free PFF Edge annual subscription. That's right. It's $40 of value for just $20. And you get the opportunity to turn that $20 into even more money playing daily fantasy and prop games at one of the fastest-growing fantasy sports sites in the U.S. in Monkey Knife Fight. So go to Monkey Knife Fight, deposit your $20, use the promo code PFF, do it today, receive a free PFF Edge annual subscription. Let's get right into the game, Sam. Starting with Thursday night, Tampa Bay Bucks at the Chicago Bears. The Bears win it in one just an ugly, weird game. I was joking, like the best passes in this game just kind of improved field goal range. It was like, it's 3rd and 29. Here's a 16-yard gain to improve your 45-yard field goal opportunity. And we got to see the wide ranges of Foles.
Yeah.
We got to see Tom Brady maybe not knowing what down it was.
Maybe.
Whether, I don't know what happened, but that was a poor display at the end.
Every time we go back to like the Thursday night game, it feels like we're traveling back like 3 weeks and doing a game that happened, you know, last season sometime.
Let's not spend too much time.
No, I mean, the story was Tom Brady forgetting the down. Like, so when we go through the Thursday night game, I'm watching, like, first of all, obviously you want to see a good game, figuring out what the storyline is because I write a reaction article coming off the back of it. And then my next mode of thought is, well, what was the key sounds for the audio montage? Because that's when I start the following week's audio montage, right? So I'm like, oh, this is perfect. Foles, they take the lead. We get another Tom Brady game-winning drive. Perfect. This is like great audio montage material. And then he forgets the down, screws it up. And you're like, well, that's just ruined it. Like my entire audio montage thing is wrecked. And I was like, hang on. No, it's not. Now it's better because the audio montage becomes about him forgetting the down. So it's perfect. So that, you know, that's just a little tease for the Thursday show.
Yeah, so tune in for the audio montage on Thursday.
May or may not feature Tom Brady forgetting what down it is.
So the Bears are now 4-1. We'll talk more about both teams coming up in the Week 6 preview. But I think for the Bucks, they needed to figure out offensively how to not rely just on, you know, big time throws from Brady because he didn't have any. And then the offense looks, you know, like it doesn't move the ball efficiently. And then with the Bears, you just really saw the wide range of Foles, right?
Yeah.
If you just followed along with the Twitter reaction to Nick Foles is terrible. Wow, nice play, Nick Foles. Nick Foles is terrible. Wow, look at that play by Foles. Trubisky couldn't do that. That was all in one night for Big Nick.
Yeah, I mean, so the Foles thing is interesting because I think fundamentally he might not even be an upgrade over Trubisky, like the baseline, right? But,
no.
But...
Well, we did debate that before.
But. Yes. Look, his baseline if you just average it out and they say every single play overall, I don't know that he's an upgrade over the version of Trubisky we were getting so far this year. Having said that, Emmanuel Acho did this really good breakdown of that big play to David Montgomery, which essentially won the game for them, right?
Yep.
Put them into scoring position, gave them the lead at the end. And he broke down essentially all the pre-snap stuff that was happening from Foles in terms of what he did to engineer that play to be open, and the stuff that you could hear because you don't have all the crowd noise, right? You can hear the checks and all this kind of stuff. I don't know that Trubisky is capable of doing that. So that play doesn't happen with Trubisky in there, right? So down to down, it's the same, but Foles is capable of doing that at the right time, which is the difference. So it's tiny, tiny margins, and generally they might not have upgraded, but they have at least put a quarterback in there who, when he's playing at this kind of average to crappy level, is at least mentally capable of pulling something out of the fire and executing a big play, which in a game like that is literally the difference between winning or losing. So it's probably still the right call. But if you're looking at this being like, ah, great, we upgraded a quarterback, everything's rosy because the roster was really good anyway, not so much.
I mean, I don't even think Bears fans are thinking that coming out of Thursday night. His first pass was sailed. He had a couple turnover-worthy plays and some, you know, some sketchy decisions in there. But, hey, the Bears pulled it off. They're 4-1 with the ugly win. We'll have more on the week six preview. Oh, you still want to stay here?
Just one small thing about the Bucks. The irony about this is they're now – Tom Brady is back in the situation he was in last year in terms of there's no receivers. You're like, oh, well, whatever about Brady in 2019, the one thing we know for sure about 2020 is he's got receivers he can get open. Look at the receiving core he's throwing to, Godwin, Mike Evans, all those tight ends. It'll be great. It's not like it was in New England. Now they're all hurt. Mike Evans is playing, but God knows he's not 100% healthy. The dude can barely move around. And then, like, he's back to just there's no receivers anymore. So, like, he's naturally the offense is struggling because Brady is back to, I can't trust any of these guys to be open.
Yeah, presumably Chris Godwin comes back from a hamstring injury. But, yeah, Evans has been battling multiple injuries throughout the season. Gronk is still, you know, not really in football shape. He's only got, like, 10 to 15 turbos in his arsenal. I think he's used two of them this season. I think that's how I'm describing Gronk.
Okay.
O.J. Howard out for the year. So, still a work in progress over there in Tampa Bay. All right, let's get to Sunday's action.
Yeah.
The Las Vegas Raiders defeat the Kansas City Chiefs in an absolute shootout. Our friend John Gruden.
Yes.
I think, so listen, I don't know for sure if he's a listener to the podcast.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, there's a pretty good shot that we're on in the background in John's office.
Well, yeah, he likes to listen. You know, that's why we have these long podcasts. John likes to grind in the office, the tape, and you need some background noise. What better sound than you and me as he goes through the film?
So John called us out,
a little bit.
He tried to.
Let's listen
to it. Yeah,
but, you know, we threw it down the field today on some of the Pro Football Focus statisticians will have to scratch their head. They're gonna have to figure out what did he really do that.
So the interesting thing about this is this week generally feels a lot like confession, you know, forgive me Father for I have sinned, because there's like a couple of things this week that I just did not see coming whatsoever. One of them was the Raiders beating the Chiefs. And it didn't quite go the way, like we said, look, the baseline, the starting point is 30 points. Now, they got there, but the Chiefs didn't. They actually did a better job against the Chiefs offense than I expected them to. But the really interesting thing is Henry Ruggs does appear to fundamentally fix Derek Carr in terms of he gives them the deep shot that Carr doesn't take when he's not on the field. And it's not always pretty, like that first catch where he had to go up and essentially moss the DB. Not a great pass, but Ruggs can pull those off, right? He's got that kind of skill set that he isn't just a blazing speedster. He's got the hops. He's got the ability to take the ball away from a defender as well. But he just fundamentally changes the way Derek Carr approaches the deep ball. And it's not that he becomes this dramatically more aggressive quarterback overall. Like, if you pull up his passing map from that game, it's wild. It's like Drew Brees-esque. Everything's around the line of scrimmage, and then there's like a bunch of deep shots and nothing in the middle, right? In theory, what you want is a quarterback that's attacking all levels of the defense, right? You have a lot of stuff in the intermediate level. You've got some short stuff. You've got the deep shots, and you can't zero in on any one area. If you can't get that, the next best thing probably is what you got from Carr yesterday, which is, I'm going to take all the easy stuff. I'm going to take a bunch of checkdowns. I'm going to rely on yards after the catch. And then every now and again, I'm going to throw a bomb over the top and see if you're prepared. So fundamentally, this is what we've been calling for, right? Carr is a technically good quarterback, but his deep shots appear more like a calculated, occasional strategic element of his game, right? I'm just going to take a shot and see if the defense is paying attention. When Ruggs is there, even if they're the same, they're more frequent, and that's vital. That's important.
But at the same time, you also have the key third down, whereas Hunter Renfrow is more just a busted coverage, and he's breaking free deep, and Carr did see that late. So it wasn't all dialed up, but your point is a good one. And either way, you know, I think either Gruden's listening to us or he read my article before the season. And the whole point, I was, you know, Derek Carr is one of the guys, if you guys have been listening to the podcast for a while, I've said, has a throw down the field type of skill set. He is capable. He has good touch. He has good zip and accuracy and all that stuff. And essentially the article I wrote before they even drafted Ruggs said, if you increase your average depth of target by at least one, you have a 20% higher chance of improving your EPA than if you decrease it. Essentially, it was how we broke it down. And I mentioned Carr in the article and said, yeah, if the Raiders add a couple playmakers that tap into Carr's downfield ability, they can elevate their offense into one of the league's most explosive units. Now, this was before Henry Ruggs. They add Ruggs, and this was our point on Thursday. Is this a Ruggs game? Is this a game where they drafted him to be their Tyreek Hill? Do we see Ruggs featured? Do we see the downfield passing game featured? Or, to your point that you love against the Chiefs, do they go and run the ball and try to play keep away? Now, Ruggs only has 6 catches in the NFL, so let's not overblow this entire thing. But 3 of them are at 45-plus yards. He had the 72-yard touchdown. And to your point, we've always talked about like the DeSean Jackson factor. Does it open up everything else in the offense? And I do think it does. If Ruggs is there and Darren Waller as a pretty solid tight end threat, I mean, that's a good 1-2 punch for the Raiders passing attack. It was an impressive effort from them offensively.
And this is what we said needs to happen if they're going to beat a team like the Chiefs, right? You can't go out there and just play this check down game against a team like that. And that was assuming you didn't do as good a job as you did on defense. But this was a massively more aggressive Carr in terms of those deep shots. Like those deep shots alone, he had more deep passing yards yesterday than he had in the 4 games before that combined, right? Like 219 to 155. So
yeah,
significantly more. This was a way more aggressive Derek Carr, even though the median pass would have been really low, like exactly where it normally is. But the mean is way higher. His average at the target measured by the mean is 9.4 yards.
It was the highest
downfield.
Highest he's had since Gruden took over, or it was right up until they were essentially running the clock out at the end. So it was the most aggressive just on a per play basis, the average, since Gruden took over.
So this is exactly what we said needed to happen. Now, I don't know. I don't think it's fundamentally changed my perception of Derek Carr in terms of how he operates. I think he's still a technically very good quarterback, but I do think it changes his ceiling. Like if he's prepared to do this when Henry Ruggs is on the field, he becomes a top 10 quarterback because this was a missing element to his game. So I may be scratching my head in terms of I didn't think this was going to happen, but this is exactly what should happen if you want to be a successful team.
Scratching your head?
No, the Derek Carr shooting deep thing.
You were scratching your head because that's what John said.
Yeah. Can we talk about the other side of the ball, though?
Yes.
Because
I have
the
thoughts.
Raiders had, to me, I was trying to work out, all right, what are they doing to Mahomes? Because he's playing badly, and this is unusual. It almost seemed like all of Mahomes' best plays, not all of them, a lot of Mahomes' best plays come when, you know, you rush, you flush him from the pocket, and then suddenly he's playing like Mahomes ball, right? And it's just running around, eventually heaves one 50 yards back across the field to an area that nobody's defending because you don't normally have to. The Raiders seem to like almost most teams, the plan is don't let him do that, right? That's when he's at his most dangerous. The same thing with Rodgers. Don't really rush because when you let him loose, that's when chaos happens and you're screwed. The Raiders seem to do it the opposite way, which is let's actually try and make him do that, but have linebackers basically primed to chase him the hell out of the pocket the second he breaks contain. and then flood everything, like cover up everything else behind that. So they would have this situation where they basically force him from the pocket in one direction, and then have the linebackers at the second level basically spying on either side. So the second he starts to come out of the pocket, those guys are sprinting after him to actually rush him into these decisions. So he doesn't just have all day to find some crazy pass that no one else can attempt. You have a linebacker chasing him down immediately and forcing him to do something like ill-advised.
I think there was some of that. I also think that the Raiders did a good job of anticipating his pocket movement and making it. He did break the pocket a lot. I mean, the bottom line, my note on this was a Texas Tech game for Patrick Mahomes. He finished with 6 big time throws, three of which didn't even count, which is part of the issue as well. Maybe one of the throws of the year to kick it off that got negated by a holding. We'll talk about that in a second. But Mahomes also had 4 turnover worthy plays in this. Now, Part of that's, you know, you're playing from behind, you got to force some stuff, which they're not usually doing. But that has not been a part of Mahomes' game. As reckless as it feels like he plays sometimes, he does not put the ball in harm's way a whole lot. The last 2 weeks, though, he has 7 turnover worthy plays against New England plus the Raiders. The last 2 weeks have been Texas Tech Mahomes. That, to me, is a little concerning. I thought the Raiders did a really good job of at least anticipating his pocket movement and not overcommitting too much. You know, so they tried to mirror him a little bit in the pocket. So that's like when he tries to get out, the key as a quarterback is how quickly can you get your eyes up the field. I think they made him maneuver just enough that he couldn't get his eyes up that quick, right? So then it takes you a little bit longer. You have to get out on a sprint. And he made a few of those crossbody throws. He made some ridiculous crossbody throws. One's dropped. You know, others just not there. Another one, you know, overthrow that should have been picked or whatever. So it was just a mixed bag all over the place. But I thought the Raiders did a pretty good job. From a Mahomes standpoint, though, I think he was just too aggressive in this one. There were plays when we always talk about the easy stuff. I break down quarterback in simple terms. There's the tough stuff and the easy stuff. The easy stuff isn't just screens. It's quick game and just first read stuff. It's just getting the ball out of your hands. Mahomes was not good at any of that yesterday. He was not taking a whole bunch of 5-yard gains on 2nd and 10, 5-yard gains on 1st and 10 when it was there. It was like he was going for the home run every single time. So I don't think he was seeing the field well. He was inviting pressure like crazy with his drops and the way he was drifting and all that stuff. So it was very Texas Tech-like. The easy stuff, quote-unquote easy stuff, that Mahomes usually executes wasn't there. But he also had 6 big-time throws, and they scored a ton of points. And that first big-time throw was 65 yards in the air to Tyreek Hill. He threw it when Tyreek was at like the 20, threw it as far as he could to the perfect spot for a negated 59-yard touchdown, which was just insane. And then there was a pass later, too, where Mahomes sees Tyreek break behind the defense and then heaves it another 60-plus yards, and it was underthrown, which, of course, it was underthrown. He had to throw it 60 yards, like, rolling to his left. It was a wide array of Mahomes. But I think the Raiders overall did a pretty solid job of discouraging some of the early stuff or at least just creating indecision so Mahomes was coming off those first reads.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I hate when those like amazing plays get chalked off by a holding call. It's just such a kick to the teeth.
Yeah. And so Mahomes' grade is going to end up pretty good in this game.
Yeah.
This is the opposite of what we had been saying about him. He could play poorly and the stats are pretty good. Like, he had so many negated good plays that the grade's going to be better than people expect, maybe based off the stats.
I think just a huge part of this game was what the Raiders managed to do when he was on the move. He was 5 for 13 when he was scrambling.
Yeah, right? And listen, 21 of his 50 dropbacks were outside the pocket.
Right.
Either by design, but most through scramble. That is an insane percentage.
Yeah, so 5 for 13, but more importantly, a PFF grade in the 60s, right? And just at the low end of the 60s, 60 point something. Since the start of 2018, when he's been scrambling, his grade is 90, right? So his completion percentage is higher. His everything is higher. He's usually phenomenal when he does that because he has time to pick the pass, find a guy that nobody is covering because you can't for that length of time and in those places, and hit him. But the Raiders did a really, really good job of figuring out where he was going to move to and close very quickly on him and basically force him to pick a pass that wasn't good. It didn't always work because Oh, yeah. It's just a difficult thing. You can't cover all those
things.
They
did a good job with that.
And he did make a couple of big-time throws in those situations, but he was dramatically less efficient than he normally is. That's usually where Mahomes absolutely kills you, and he didn't in this game.
I thought the Raiders just did a good job, again, of creating a decision. They almost disguised – they were spinning their safeties pretty much every single play, some sort of we're starting single high, we're going to two high. I mean, they were doing a pretty good job of all of that. And when you they roll to two high a lot, and when you face a two high, two deep safety looks, the underneath stuff is generally open. You can flood the underneath zones, but the Raiders also did a nice job of mixing up man and zone. I think there was more profit to take for Mahomes that he didn't take. So I want to credit the Raiders defense, not because everything was covered all the time, but I think they created enough indecision in Mahomes so that they could make enough plays. It's a shootout.
His average depth of target, by the way, on those scramble plays was 19 yards. At some point, take a shorter shot.
But he had one. I mean, he has gotten away with it. He has one interception on the season. He has gotten, and it was on fourth down. It was a misread, but it was on fourth down. But man, he has gotten away with a ton of passes over the last couple weeks that should have been picked, including one that was in the end. He threw one up right to Trayvon Mullen in the end zone, and Mullen tripped and should have picked it off. So, man, any thoughts on – Kansas City has not been dominant this year.
No.
Outside of the Baltimore game, they have not had one game where – and obviously they lost this game, but they even in their wins they haven't dominated. Any concerns in Kansas City?
I mean, this game I think was concerning. More – late in the game, you know, the Chiefs, when you put them in this double-digit hole, it's almost where they're most comfortable in that offense, right? Where Mahomes can just go out there and say, we're passing every down, I'm going to get this done. And late in the game, they were chasing, and it felt like, look, they're going to score twice, but your problem is you can't stop the Raiders at the moment. Like that, I think, was their bigger concern. Not that Mahomes had a bad game and that the offense wasn't really clicking. Late in the game, you had no problem whatsoever in believing that they could score as many times as required, but you couldn't stop them. That was, I think, a way bigger concern, that this defense has typically been really good and been a big part of them being this dominant juggernaut. The defense couldn't stop the Raiders, particularly when they added that threat of the deep shot that was there.
Raiders,
that I think was a concern for them.
The Chiefs do a really good job taking away the intermediate middle. They just take away the middle field.
Which is the one thing that the Raiders had no interest in taking in the first place.
And that's what the Raiders did a really good job of getting behind on some of those deep balls. And then the Raiders, this is the story of the game. The Raiders passed for over 200 yards on third down alone. Like, that's it.
Yeah.
That's the story of the game. So good job, John Gruden. Appreciate you reading my article on Derek Carr saying, hey, he's the next guy to take the step forward. This guy. Raiders win. And they continue to have impressive wins when, they beat the Chiefs, beat the Saints.
Yeah, so this is my first confessional today. There's another one later on. We'll get to that.
I have a confession.
Oh, yeah? What you got?
And an apology.
Ooh.
We apologize for completely neglecting the state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
On Thursday.
Scott Hansen on Red Zone, Andrew Siciliano, official friend of the show, as we'll get to later.
You're cheating on Andrew.
I don't have DirecTV, so I have to listen to Scott on a Sunday.
Andrew, can we get some DirecTV for Sam over here, please?
Right. He was calling Pennsylvania some weird-ass name of the state. What the hell was it? It's Keystone State. Was that it? Does that sound familiar?
Right, yeah.
The Keystone State. What? Okay. He just kept banging on about this Battle of Pennsylvania is the Keystone State game.
Well, right. You're American. Do some research on it.
Not yet. I don't have to pass the citizenship test for a while.
So we apologize to our YouTube viewers. I think you went into the comments and gave your little preview.
Yeah.
To the listeners, we just apologize. We completely forgot it.
Oops.
Sam's fault. So we forgot the game. We apologize. Let's discuss it right now. A back-and-forth battle between the Eagles and the Steelers. It was really a back-and-forth battle between Travis Fulgham and Chase Claypool.
Of course.
Which
is what everybody thought going into this
game. That's what we would have said in our preview. Mm-hmm. We would have said, look, this is going to come down to Travis Fulgham and Chase Claypool. And whoever has more touchdowns in the end is going to win.
Yes.
And there it is. Chase Claypool finds the end zone four times, so Steelers win. Good analysis by the PFF NFL podcast.
Yeah, well done.
What do you think?
Well, the Claypool thing is kind of wild. Like, he... You know, it's obviously this running joke that the Steelers just find receivers everywhere. Doesn't matter, like, where you draft them. Now, my plan will be, if I like a receiver in the draft, it's not going to be caring about how high he goes, so I can be like, hey, see, I told you this
guy.
If
he goes to the Steelers, he'll be okay.
It's just going
to
be, I don't care what round he goes in, as long as he goes to Pittsburgh. Therefore, he'll be good. Yeah, like Claypool, obviously he's this big, physical, imposing receiver to the point where people were calling him a tight end, you know, in the pre-draft process because he was so big. But he's got speed and he's got movement skills that are rare for a guy of that size. His touchdown over Nate Gary was just ridiculous. To the point where Gary was beaten so badly that it looked like a bust from the safety, because that's how far away from being anywhere near the play he was.
Struggled.
He was the middle linebacker and essentially a Tampa 2. And just Claypool just freezes him with his move and then runs the hell right by him. And it was like watching an oil tanker turn around and try and head back in the opposite direction. He was just toasted. But Claypool looks legit. And you add him to those receivers that are already really good, really diverse. That's a scary looking receiving core all of a sudden. And as I said on the radio before this, Roethlisberger doesn't have to be that good, because everyone he's throwing to is.
It might be crazy. Ben Roethlisberger, who is usually, you know, high up there in big time throws, especially most recent years, he'll miss a ton of throws. So, you know, the grade ends up pretty good, whatever. He only has 6 big time throws. That's in the 20s among quarterbacks. It is just not a classic Big Ben type of season so far. And then with Claypool, I really thought, hey, you've got Juju. Deontay Johnson, who's been banged up, only played 4 snaps as a receiver yesterday. I thought those guys would be the volume guys. And Claypool would kind of battle James Washington to be the vertical threat, you know. And then that overall body of work would be pretty good. It looks like Claypool's even more than that. I mean, he's a vertical threat, but you use the speed on crossers. You can use him in different ways. That's scary. Now, when you add that to Juju and Deontay into James Washington. And then if Ben gets the ball down the field a little bit more efficiently, because he hasn't thrown the ball down the field all that well, this is a tough offense to defend.
He should have had a 5th touchdown.
He should have.
He got one negated through offensive pass interference, essentially because he just beat up the DB so badly that they threw a pity flag on it. But he won. He should have had a 5th touchdown, because he just destroyed the guy. Claypool was incredible.
Also, what this game does, opposing defenses they're going to know where Chase Claypool is now.
Yeah.
If nothing else, if he doesn't catch a pass the rest of the season, he's opening stuff up for everyone else, because he becomes the DK Metcalf of this offense. Right. I got to know where this guy is. I have to have the proper cornerback on him. I have to know, because he is a mismatch weapon.
Well, particularly when he's still not playing. It's not like he's an every down player yet, right? He's still only a bit part player in this offense. So the second he comes onto the field, it becomes a giant red flag, right?
Right.
It's oh, hell, look, he's coming in, everything focus on this. You change the defense just by sending him out into the personnel package. The other takeaway I had from this game is that Carson Wentz might be fixed. Now, I know there was a really ugly interception in there, but there was a lot. Carson Wentz didn't look in this game the way he's looked the rest of the season. And even last week, the first half, he looked bad, right? He got fixed towards the back end of last week. And it was was that him actually rediscovering his mojo, or did he just get lucky for a few plays? Carson Wentz played pretty well in this. Again, when you consider that his receivers are still Greg Ward and Travis Fulgham, he didn't suddenly get a healthy receiving core and offensive line to work with. He's still dealing with a pretty rough situation. And yet Carson Wentz looked like the guy he's looked like before.
Yeah. So, I think what I said previously, he was in a slump. That's not his career baseline. You know, I said on Pittsburgh radio the other day, I was he's playing like Blaine Gabbert. I mean, that's the reality.
Oh, God.
It's the reality of how well he's played.
Yeah.
But Blaine Gabbert has a history of being Blaine Gabbert. So you would say Blaine Gabbert's going to continue to play like Blaine Gabbert.
Blaine Gabbert will probably continue to be Blaine Gabbert.
But Carson Wentz, who currently is playing like Blaine Gabbert, has a baseline of being better. Therefore, he should come out of it.
Mm.
So it's not surprising for him to come out of it at some point, right? So let's just make sure he's out of his slump. So yeah, I would be, as an Eagles fan, I'd at least be encouraged by that. And the fact that you might only need 4 wins to win the division. So the Eagles are still very much in this thing.
Can we just revisit the Rams thing again?
No, we will. Do we have the banner? Do we have the Rams NFC East Championship banner?
The Rams are now 4-0 against the NFC East. The NFC East, collectively, do they only have three wins still? Am I reading that right?
Cowboys 2, Eagles 1.
Yeah.
Washington 1.
No, they've got the three teams at the top all have one win.
The Cowboys have 2.
Not according to this. No. Did this not update?
It's 4-4. How about the scheduling quirk on that, though? The Rams are 4-0 against the NFC East.
So it's 4-4, yeah. Google has the wrong win for they've given.
Google doesn't know what they're
Google
doing.
Google gave Dallas a loss yesterday. It's a bit harsh.
Well, they lost Dak.
I mean, sure, but I don't. Anyway, the point is that the Rams at 4-0 have as many wins as the NFC East combined.
Actually, I'm going to move that game up. By the way, I forgot.
Okay, the NFC East combined against everybody through 5 weeks has as many wins as the Rams have against their division.
Are they the new? How hard could it be?
The NFC East? I mean, this is wretched. Like, I was talking the radio this morning. It was like, are Dallas still, like, is their season sunk because they have Dak? And the answer is no, because this division is wide open. The same thing is true for the Eagles. Like, Carson Wentz has been playing like Blaine Gabbert for the first month of the season, and they're first place in the division with a record of 1-2-1. Like, this division, I mean, people talk about 500 winning this division. Like, 6-10 could win this division.
There's a tough balance when you're analyzing football. There's a tough balance between taking in new information and what we call our priors or whatever, but like the bigger body of work. The bigger body of work for this Eagles team, especially when they get guys healthy, is that they should be pretty good. Carson Wentz should be at least a mid-tier quarterback.
Right.
And they shouldn't be this bad. So in that sense, they should be getting better. So you want to, but on the other hand, the new information is they're all depleted. Wentz was playing horribly, so how much better will he get? And, you know, the defense has some issues
on the back end. You tried to sully the good name of Jordan Mailata yesterday by pointing out that on one particular play he got whooped by Bud Dupree.
Yes.
I would point you to Jordan Mailata's exceptionally average grade and say that as a former rugby player, that's a pretty good job.
That's good. He'll have, you know, 4 or 5 pressures surrendered by the time the grades come out. PFF Elite Premium Stats 2.0, if you guys have it. He's played all right.
For an offensive line that is wrecked by injuries, he is not a problem.
Yeah, that's...
I term that a success.
Good job. Bud Dupree absolutely whooped him on that.
It was
sack,
ugly.
Though.
But I said that we should only... It's only right and proper and fair that we redress the balance and Jordan Mailata an end around and run it right at Bud Dupree the next play.
No, that I agree. But you can't be biased. Like, when George Fant was getting whooped, you weren't like, well, he's pretty good for a basketball player who never played football. You made fun of George Fant.
He's American. Like, he grew up with the game.
Yeah, but he played like 12 snaps in college.
I had this, like, it's osmosis. You've seen it happen. You understand how it works. Jordan Mailata was running over people playing rugby. He'd never seen the game before.
Overall, though, the Steelers pass rush did get after... It didn't feel like it, I don't think, as a Steelers fan, if you're a Steelers fan. And it doesn't feel like their coverage grade coming into the game was 20th. Last year they were 5th. I think, again, the caveat of coming in saying, hey, our defense is great, we're going to be okay. This defense is not nearly as good as it was last year.
But do you think that a big part of that is how much more aggressive they are this year? Like, they are blitzing more than anybody else in the NFL in a way they didn't a year ago. That exposes your back end in a way it wasn't a year ago. Like, you're asking more of your coverage unit this year than you were a season ago. Therefore, it's not grading as well.
There's something to it, but it's also a team that, you know, when TJ Watt's out there and feeling pretty good, and Bud, you know, Bud's not a terrible pass rusher. He's at least reasonable and somebody that they account for. And then the interior put, like, they don't need to be blitzing like that. So that's
right. I mean, that's almost a separate thing, though, in terms of, like, why are they doing it? But I think that explains what's happening. Like, their coverage unit isn't as good as it was last season because you're hanging them out to dry more than you were with the on the basis that you're pressuring more.
Either way, so they're a team too. You would say maybe that, you know, the defense is still capable, and with the emerging offensive star that is Chase Claypool and the guys that they have there, Big Ben still there. I mean, Pittsburgh's one of those teams that they're going to be scary for the rest of the AFC. I think you know, a couple matchups with Baltimore, and it's going to be a pretty heated AFC, I think.
And the fun thing is that the teams that we thought were sort of untouchable have each taken a knock, right? Baltimore got their ass kicked by the Chiefs, and the Chiefs just lost to the Raiders. Like, the two teams that we thought were head and shoulders above anybody else.
Right.
And then it was who joins them. Does Buffalo get into that? Does Pittsburgh get into that? I mean, now Buffalo and Pittsburgh haven't lost yet. But Baltimore and Kansas City have each looked mortal and weak in a specific game.
Well, let's get to the Dak stuff. The Giants and the Cowboys. The Cowboys pull it off. The Giants showed signs of life offensively. Thank you, Dallas Cowboys defense. But
yeah,
it wasn't just the defense. I mean, there was defensive touchdowns in there and everything. It was a crazy game. But Dak going down is obviously the story. I think you see the respect that he has, not just from his teammates, but everybody. I mean, look, injuries happen all the time. But given everything that he's gone through on, off the field, the well-publicized contract negotiations, if you're a fan, sometimes you're just like, hey, player, sign this contract for my favorite team. This is one of the few contract negotiations that's been out there. And there's always that whole, do you play year to year? Do you play it out? I mean, there's an injury right in the middle of this guy about to get paid. And, you know, he's been the guy for Dallas since Tony Romo took over. So heart goes out to Dak. What do you think? What were you thinking during this whole thing?
That was as big an outpouring of sort of sympathy and grief as I've seen from a player getting badly injured. It sucks for him. I mean, part of the reason why I don't really have a problem most of the time with players playing on that 1 year guarantee deal. One, because it's a lot of money anyway. It's not like it's a problem. Like, if you don't play again, you just got $30 million guaranteed.
Yeah, you're not set for life.
Right. You're still fine. It's just you didn't maximize what you could have gotten. But also because most injuries now are not... like, the threat of a career-ending injury in today's NFL is pretty small. And there's no better evidence of that than Alex Smith, who we'll get to later. Like, that guy barely had a leg by the time his medical issues had finished, and he just played an NFL game again. So the idea that like you could risk your career by getting an injury and never playing again, I think it's pretty small now in a way it wasn't in the 80s or wherever, right? On the other hand, like Dak's injury, the one that he got with a compound ankle fracture and dislocation maybe, that's as close as it gets to like that's a real long-term concern. So it's a major injury for him and a huge risk, and hopefully he just gets back 100% and it won't be any kind of problem. But it does throw those negotiations into chaos now, because like, who the hell knows what Dak Prescott's going to be like or how long that's going to last or what the recovery timetable looks like in terms of like when you can actually start negotiating from a position of strength again if you're Dak, right? Because the longer this went, this is the only scenario whereby the number gets smaller for Dak's contract.
Right.
Every other scenario, he was only pushing the price upwards by holding out. That's going to be a nightmare for him to negotiate in terms of proving to Dallas that he's back healthy and therefore is worth $40 million a season. And then the other element of this is why Andy Dalton is there, right? He comes in and everything that rang true for Dak still holds true for Dalton. You have one of the best receiving groups in the NFL. Offensive line is a problem. It was a problem for Dak as well, but you've got places to go with the football, and Dalton is able to get them there.
Yeah.
We saw even in the second half that he was able to put the ball where it needs to go, give his receivers a chance to make a play, and late in the game in particular, it was Michael Gallup making the plays, but like they can win games with Andy Dalton, the quarterback.
Yeah, just to finish up the Dak thing, highest grade of his career, 86.2 right now. It's kind of how he started out last season too, but he's played better the last couple of years after a bit of a lull, 2017 and 18, that has paired up with the supporting cast improving. And I think that's the biggest key for Dallas right now. I think they'll still have an efficient passing attack. This is the best group of playmakers Andy Dalton has thrown to since 2015. His 2015 season is like one of my sample, you know, the examples that I use over and over again. Hey, you can grab Andy Dalton and pair him with three or four good playmakers and get good passing production. That's what they have in Dallas with Amari Cooper, with CeeDee Lamb, who, by the way, CeeDee Lamb is emerging as a middle of the field threat.
Yeah.
And you know, contested catches and yak ability. That's interesting to me because I saw him as like the purest outside receiver in this draft. But he's been good there. And then Gallup, we saw what he could do. You know, you chuck it up to him, he can make plays. I mean, that is three legit playmakers. Dalton also has one of the quickest releases in the NFL historically.
Yeah.
He gets rid of the ball. So he will probably be able to protect an offensive line that is completely depleted now that Tyron Smith is out for the season, Lyle Collins out for the season. Dalton, now he needs a good offensive line. We saw what happened in Cincinnati, but I think for the most part, he gets rid of the ball quickly enough to protect them a little bit.
Well, or he needs a good, like a receiving corps that's so good at offsets.
They get open. They got to get open quick.
Yeah, yes. Which they can. So, yeah, look, and I you know, want to underscore the idea that, look, we hope, obviously, Dak Prescott comes back 100%, and this is as routine an injury as it
Correct.
Can be. He gets, you know, surgery went well, he gets recovered, and he becomes long-term starter there.
Rooting for Dak here.
Right. But I don't think Dallas's season is done because Dak Prescott is done. I think Andy Dalton is a capable starting NFL quarterback that can still win you games given the situation around him.
Yeah, I completely agree there. The Giants are playing some teams tough over the last couple weeks. Daniel Jones and that. I mean, they just have – they're going to have some decisions to make.
Dude, that fumble was so bad.
With the Giants.
How do you not see that coming?
He looks like he's trying to fumble a little bit when he's maneuvering the pocket. But Jones is getting more into, you know, putting the ball in harm's way like he did last year a little bit more. Early in the season, he was playing a little bit better than the stats would show based off our grades, and it has been a rough situation for them there. But Giants got some work to do. I mean, I'm with you on Dallas. I think they still have to figure it out defensively and make some more plays there.
Yeah,
but they should still be in the mix in this. How hard could it be? NFC East,
right? Particularly as I say, 6-10 could win that division. Like Dallas is. Their biggest problem right now is not the fact that they lost Dak Prescott. It's that defense still can't stop anybody. Like, you turn the New York Giants into the best offense in the NFL. Like, that is your issue. You can't stop anybody. So every game has to be a shootout. And now you're in a shootout without your quarterback. So the defense, they need to figure out some way of turning that around before you go anywhere. But this division is going to be wide open to win for a long time because nobody is stepping up.
Quick break to tell you about our friends over at Pristine Auction. This whole episode is brought to you by PristineAuction.com. Check out the daily auctions with $1 starting bids on over 8,000 football items all up for auction. Pristine Auction guarantees authenticity on every product, so use promo code PFF for $10 off your first invoice. And right now, we're currently giving away a signed Jerry Rice jersey. This is awesome. So go rate and review the podcast wherever you're listening. If it's Apple, you just go make the review. Rate it 5 stars.
Yes.
That's the rule. Mm-hmm. And we'll be choosing a winner next week. So leave us some sort of social media handle or some way of contacting you. Email if you want to put it out there. But some way of contacting you. And we'll pick a winner for a free Jerry Rice jersey. Sam's number two receiver of all time?
Sure. More or less.
Behind Randy?
Yeah, obviously. I mean, who can't have anybody other than Randy.
Yeah. All right, let's get to the Indianapolis Colts and the Cleveland Browns. You're 4-1 Cleveland Browns. There is a buzz in Cleveland. Can you believe it? Like, people are through the roof. I'm happy for Browns fans here.
The last time they were 4-1, Bill Belichick was the coach. The
Scott Pioli had hair, as he tweeted out last night.
The first season of Friends was on TV.
91? Wasn't it 91?
94.
Was it 94? Yeah, that's when Friends came out that year. Yeah.
First season of Friends. It was a whole bunch of stuff they threw up on the TV late in the game, and that's the only one I can remember. I was going to go through the list, but I can't remember what the rest of them were.
Also in 1994, shout out to the North Reading Little League Giants. We won the championship that year.
Yeah.
My buddy Mike, game-winning homer. Huh. Man, 94 was a good year.
Yeah.
It was a good year.
I can't believe that one didn't go up on the TV.
Well, we'll put it up. We'll get a graphic. Can we get a graphic, please, on Mike hit a 3-run homer. Mm-hmm. Mike has never hit a home run in his entire life. And all of a sudden, boom, home run in the biggest game of our life when we're 12. Anyway, the Cleveland Browns, as I was joking yesterday, this felt like Phillip Rivers and Baker Mayfield taking turns trying to throw the game away.
Yeah.
Rivers ultimately won that battle of throwing things away. But here's the thing. Rivers, as much as I've been defending him, kind of look, you've got LaRaven Clark is trying to block Myles Garrett the entire game.
Yeah.
Rivers knows that. He was playing like Baker last year, where Baker's like, I got Greg Robinson in my blind side. Let me just make sure he's blocking his guy. You know, that's what it felt like the whole time with Rivers. And then, you know, Rivers throws the pick six where he's late to the flat. He wasn't even under pressure there. He felt like he was under pressure even when he wasn't. And he just chucks it late to the flat for a pick six. He's got the the safety in the end zone, where again, like it was, he ended up getting hit, but it was kind of in pressure that he was responsible for. It was a little ugly for Phillip.
Yeah, but LaRaven Clark against Myles Garrett was one of those matchups that can kill a game all by itself.
Yeah.
It was a drive early on where it was like bank-to-bank-to-bank plays where Garrett's just around and wrecking it. Like, if you don't figure – and they weren't, he was having no help early in the game. Like, if you can't anticipate that that's going to be a problem, and after maybe, like, the first one, be like, all right, we thought we'd give it a shot, but no, we need to deploy plan B, right, the chip blocks. Like, they were just letting him go one-on-one, and you can't block him. Like, that's Myles Garrett out there, and you're LaRaven Clark. How do you think that's going to go? So, yeah, that was a major problem for them. The Browns are interesting, though, because this offense is functioning exactly the way you think it should, right, in terms of Stefanski comes in, brings the system with him. This is what we're supposed to be doing. And Baker Mayfield's not playing well right now. And actually,
he's not at all.
This game, he really didn't play well. Like, he had at least been more accurate the past couple of weeks, even if he hadn't actually been playing that well. But he wasn't even accurate in this game. It's like every pass, except for one late on where he showed a bit of touch, he sort of plays like Fitzpatrick in terms of it looks like he's trying to throw his life force into every pass, right? Just bullets flying left and right. Like, dude, just, you don't need to put everything into every pass. Dial it back a notch. Like,
that might be, you know, as we go back and we're trying to think, what did we miss in the evaluation process? Was that part of it, that he doesn't have the full array of throws? I mean, it wasn't like he would throw deep post and he would, but like the pure touch pass, like Marcus Mariota came out, I don't think he had great he was a touch thrower, but he didn't have great arc on the ball. I don't know if Baker's missing a couple throws from the bag, or if he has just resorted to, I want to chuck it.
That's the thing, right? Because the problem with Baker and the what do we miss thing is that rookie Baker was really good. Like, rookie Baker looked like the complete package. He had everything there. The tools were all there. Everything we saw in college translated immediately to the NFL level. You're like, hey, we nailed it.
Right.
And then like year two, it fell off a cliff, and now we're sort of figuring out where in the middle he's going to land. But the guy playing now is not the guy from his rookie season. I don't know if they fundamentally broke him last season, but Baker Mayfield now is not the guy that he should have been or that he should be. And that's what's weird to me, is that, like, if you had told me that 5 weeks through the season, all these things for Cleveland's offense would be functioning, right? The system would look great. Odell Beckham starting to look like old Odell Beckham. Jarvis Landry is a bigger part of the offense. The run game is fantastic. The scheme is functioning and getting people open. I'd be like, oh, Baker's grade is going to be back where it was in his rookie season. He's going to be 80 plus in PFF system. He's not even in the ballpark. Like, he's nowhere near that. And everything around him is better. That is not just concerning, but it's also weird. Like, I don't understand why he's not a better part of the system.
The system did a nice job. The play calling, the play action game did a nice job of creating a lot of open throws early in the game. But again, down the stretch, Baker hasn't really had a clean four-quarter game in a long time. A couple weeks ago, he played all right, but like there hasn't been a clean one in a while. And down the stretch, he's throwing some risky passes, essentially, when they're winning, right?
Yeah.
So that I think is also part of the concern. It's just taking care of the football when you're supposed to be, taking the throws that the system gives you. Yes, I don't know. I've got some concerns about the way he's playing, but they're doing a nice job of playing around it. The running game's been solid. I want to credit the Browns linebackers, who I can't remember if I had him 31st. I think I had him 31st in the preseason rankings because the Rams were just so bad on paper coming in. But Malcolm Smith, Sione Takitaki, Malik Wilson all played solid while they were out there. I mean, it just the back seven, I thought, for the Browns, they played pretty well, especially in the middle of the field where Rivers was throwing them the football.
Yes, that'll help. Baker, by the way, injured his ribs late in the game. Also looked like he ran into his shoulder, got dumped on.
Shoulder looked like it was smoked.
I don't know if it was the same injury, but the shoulder, like, he definitely got driven into the turf, was having problems, and then took a really minor shot a little while later and immediately started clutching his ribs. I don't know if like the first hit jarred something loose and the second hit aggravated it, or if they were two completely separate injuries. But either way, he had x-rays on the ribs. They were negative. But next week, you're going to get a less than 100% Baker playing against Pittsburgh's Blitzburg defense. that's a challenge.
Now, that teaser alert, that's probably going to be one of our biggest games that we're going to preview
right
this week. Believe it or not, the Browns and the Steelers, one of the games of the week in week six. And it's 4-1 versus 4-1. It's going to be awesome.
This was the game.
This
was the game that Philip Rivers can't have. You know what I mean? Like, they bring Philip Rivers in to be not Jacoby Brissett. Like, this was Jacoby Brissett. He could have gone out and done that.
Sorry, 4-0 Steelers, right?
Yes. Yes.
Google's still saying 3-0 for them too.
Google's not. It's having a bad
day. Why did
I
give them a loss in my head for no reason? That was mean.
Google's having a rough day in terms of updating the NFL alerts or the NFL scores, apparently. But this, like, Jacoby Brissett could have had that game. You know what I mean? Like, what's the point in Philip Rivers if you're going to go out and play like that?
Well, Jacoby would have taken better care of the ball.
Right. Four turnover-worthy plays for Rivers, including that one, the late shot putt to the flat is just, like, not a good idea.
Yeah, and again, it was one of those where I always describe the Chargers' offensive line as the walls caving in. Maybe it's just the way Rivers reacts to everything.
It is in part. But
he had a clean pocket to step into. And he just, you know, right. Rookie mistake, late to the flat.
But this was the first game where his offensive line was kind of like the Chargers, right? Like, not across the board, but suddenly there was
a problem spot.
Yeah, and you know there's a problem and you have to deal with it. Like, before, for the first few weeks of the season, the Colts offensive line hasn't been the best in the NFL, but it's been the best it's ever been put in front of Rivers. And consequently, it hasn't really affected his game. This was the first week where I think it probably did, and you saw, like, a complete implosion that looked like 2019 Rivers.
All right, let's get to Sunday Night Football. Was the Minnesota Vikings and the Seattle Seahawks. Minnesota, when you talk about this explosive Seattle offense, Minnesota did such a good job in the first half, taking away all of the deep shots. There was a point where Seattle had only dropped back nine times with five net passing yards because Russell Wilson had taken three sacks. They were taking away the deep shots. Seattle kept dialing them up. It was one of those games where I think the schemes don't mesh. But over time, it evened out, and Seattle ended up making their plays. But it was a good one. 27-26, Seattle pulled it off.
This game was ridiculous. The Vikings dominated the entire first half, went into the halftime with a double-digit lead. Seattle erased the entire thing and then some in like a few minutes in the third quarter. And then suddenly it becomes like a back-and-forth battle because Cousins just needed to be put in a hole to start dealing. Dalvin Cook goes down. The offense changes anyway. And then it comes down to this fourth down decision for the Vikings. Fourth and one in the shadow of Seattle's goal line. Do you go for it? If you get the conversion, you basically end Seattle's chance of winning. They don't get it. We've argued about this already. You can pause it where there's a giant hole to the right of the fullback, not the
Listen,
left.
Don't get pulled in by freeze frame, still picture Twitter.
I wouldn't, except that I thought the same thing live when I saw the motion shot. Like, I fully appreciate that the run is designed to go where it went. Like, Madison hit the hole he was supposed to hit. On the other hand, the hole just to the right of that was a lot bigger, even though the linebacker's leverage is working to that side. The problem is that the right tackle is losing his block in the gap you're hitting. So either way, you're running into a defender's leverage. But if you go right, you're running into a defender's leverage with another 2.5 yards of space. I'm just saying Dalvin Cook would have hit the gap and converted the fourth down.
Well, yeah, Dalvin's awesome.
So anyway, the Vikings go for it, don't get it. And then Seattle ends up driving down the length, taking like four shots with DK Metcalf, eventually getting one of them and winning the game.
Yeah, DK is becoming just like that man-child in the NFL. I mean, they 4th and 10, they threw it up. That was Dantzler, right? Cam Dantzler just lost track of the football in the air. It should have been.
Which he did a few times in that game.
It should have been a contested catch. DK, it wasn't even contested. DK just went up and got it. And then even then, it's funny because when you're watching Russell Wilson the whole time, he's that good. You're expecting him to pull it off and expecting him to pull it off. But then it's like, hey, it's 4th and 10. Maybe it's not going to. Okay, it happened. And then it's 4th and goal. Maybe it's not. Okay, he makes a ridiculous throw up and away from coverage to DK for the game winner. He did also, you know, fail at his first comeback attempt with a bad interception up the seam. He just threw it right to Eric Wilson. Wilson was all over the field making plays. It was a second turnover-worthy play of the year. But ultimately, you know, Wilson made a ton of his usual array of big-time throws.
I can't tell if it's skill or he's just done it by essentially coincidence and luck a couple of times this season, but DK Metcalf has been insanely good at catching the ball and then immediately shifting it just a little bit from where he caught it so that the hand coming in to swipe it misses. He did it to Stephon Gilmore on that giant deep touchdown. You know, he caught the ball and then like moves the ball and Gilmore's arm just shucks down the side, doesn't actually get a swipe on the ball. And then he did it for the touchdown right at the end. He just catches it, moves it just a little bit. So was it Anthony Harris? Doesn't get a clean shot at the ball. Like, it's incredible what the margins are. It's not, I thought initially it was like strength to avoid the contact, but it isn't. He's subtly moving it just before the hit comes and avoiding the shot from the DB that punches it out. Now, it didn't always work. He got Mike Hughes punched one out that could have easily been a touchdown a couple of plays before that. But it's insane how good he's been at doing that.
That was really close.
I would have given a touchdown for that.
Yeah, the first near touchdown. Anyway, it was an exciting game that we weren't expecting, or maybe you weren't expecting. The rain game, too. There's always a little bit of rain in Seattle a couple times a year.
Well, also, it's raining. It's the Minnesota Vikings. It's Mike Zimmer. You expect them to come out and run the ball like 98 straight times. But the first drive, it was like passing. They come out slinging it left and right. Then they go to the run game, having established the lead. And then later on, they get back into it by like it was bizarre. The Vikings almost set out to do the exact opposite of what you were expecting them to do from an offensive standpoint.
Well, yeah, I mean, running it with the lead is okay, but I think that's where, again, it gets like a little iffy. It's not like, hey, we got that 13-point lead. Let's make sure we just sit on this thing. You're literally two deep balls away from, you know,
right,
losing the lead.
I mean, they eradicated that lead almost immediately.
Right. Seattle scored, what, three times in about a minute and a half.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought Mike Zimmer overall, though, he was aggressive. You know, early on, they went for fourth and ones. They went a lot.
Yeah.
When, you know, on fourth down and everything. That's why I was joking on Twitter. You know, you don't want to have an elite quarterback. It makes the other team more aggressive. When does that start to come back to bite you? Well, it doesn't. But it is true. Like, if you are the underdog, that's part of why you need to be more aggressive and use four downs instead of three.
That's how you have to play that game. And I'm interested to know that if they hadn't already gone for it a couple of times, whether they would have gone for the one that on their like their own 20 something, or if that was just like a bridge too far, that there's no scenario by which they would have gone for that.
We're seeing that more and more. As Mina Kimes tweeted out, we saw the Bucs, and you know, Bruce Arians isn't really the most aggressive coach. They went for it on fourth and one on the 20 against Nick Foles.
That, I think, is the one area where the analytics push is really starting to get through. This idea of, we're seeing it on 2 points as well, but the fourth down thing is just, it's up so much over a few years ago. Teams have figured out that this is actually the right call. And even a guy like Mike Zimmer is, you know, at the end, you know, old Mike, who's staunchly old school, anti-analytics and data, is like, if we convert that, we win the game. I was trying to win the game, the end. Like, that's the right call. I'm not taking your revisionist, you know, hindsight is 20/20 bull. That was the right call, and we just didn't convert.
Yeah, you're one play away from winning the game,
yep,
essentially. And even if you don't get it, Seattle still had to put together a 10-15, a long drive to come back.
One last point on this game. Drew Samia is a problem.
Who
for
is
the
he?
Vikings.
For the people
he's
that
their
don't
know. Right guard. Yes. He's their current right guard on the basis that they've already had some injuries and he's the guy that they're left with, right? My question last night is simply, how bad can his backup possibly be? I know he's not the original backup, but there is a body. If he goes down in the game, there is a guy you are throwing onto the field rather than play with 10 men on offense and four offensive linemen, right? Whoever that is should be on the field at some point just to find out how bad it could possibly be, because right now, Samia is like one of the worst offensive linemen in the NFL, and he's causing the offense on his own to get wrecked.
Yeah, the
figure
guard
out how
play,
bad the backup is.
Guard play by the Vikings was horrible. The Seahawks defensive line has not gotten pressure all year. They were actually rushing the passer pretty well against this Vikings line.
Yeah.
So that's all Seattle needed, mm-hmm, was to go up against the Vikings line. I want to combine the next two because there's some stories coming out of yesterday's game. The Carolina Panthers beat the Atlanta Falcons, and the Houston Texans beat the Jacksonville Jaguars. The Texans have a coaching change.
Yes.
And the Atlanta Falcons now have a coaching change.
And GM change.
And GM change. Just saying. A couple jobs open right now. So, Carolina, first of all.
You got your Prezi ready?
Working on it.
Okay.
I think PowerPoint still works, don't... Anyway. Let's talk about the Falcons. Blowing it all up. Is this a good move? Is this a good move here? I wasn't expecting Dimitroff, to be honest. I thought it was going to be Dan Quinn. I wasn't expecting the whole top.
The Quinn part, I think, was inevitable, right? I mean, this has been a mess. And there's no... It's one of those messes that... Where's the turnaround? Like, this is not getting fixed anytime soon. This is headed too far down a bad road, so let's blow it up and start over. The Dimitroff part is interesting. But I think... I guess they just felt like this is too fundamental a change. Let's just clean house and start over. I don't know. That's the wrong idea, to be honest. I mean, this team is a disaster right now.
For the Panthers, I keep coming back to, man, they shouldn't be this good on paper. Now, I was on Carolina radio a few weeks ago, and they were like, how bad is this Christian McCaffrey injury? I said, they might be better because they're going to pass more. Top 10 in EPA since McCaffrey went down. Our friend Trent Dilfer is still saying, impressive job by the Panthers. Imagine what happens when Christian McCaffrey gets back. I understand the sentiment, but...
It's not as bad as some of the things that were said last night about Dak Prescott's injury.
Oh, gosh. Either way, I like Trent, by the way. He's awesome. Carolina 3-2, and I think showing their ability to spread the ball around, again, get the ball in DJ Moore's hands, yards after the catch. Teddy Bridgewater played a much cleaner game here that we expected. Like, he's not going to put the ball in harm's way every week.
That's the second forgive me, Father, for I have sinned.
Oh, there you go. You were yelling at Teddy.
That's not even the one I was talking about, but that's the second one. I was saying, the Teddy thing's going to come back to catch him, but actually he played way better in this game and didn't put the ball in harm's way.
Yeah. And look, it's Atlanta's defense in a dome and all that fun stuff. But, you know, impressive. The three wins for the Carolina Panthers. I thought they might finish the season with 3-5. So they're doing a good job there. And I think that's when you, the thing about like a first year coach, it doesn't, you know, if you just outperform your expectations, I think that bodes well for the future. And I think that's where Matt Rhule is. For Atlanta, they've got some, Matt Ryan has a massive dead cap hit for next year. But it's an interesting situation they're in there, right? Matt Ryan has regressed a little bit these last couple years, but they've just got such a good foundation with the receivers and, you know, some of the other weapons and offensive pieces. It's going to take a defensive overhaul there. So fascinated to see where they go from an organizational standpoint.
Yeah. Robbie Anderson has turned into like a complete number one receiver. Like, not just this deep threat and not just a deep threat with some yak ability. Now he's making like contested one-handed grabs down the sideline. Yeah. Like, this guy is actually a legitimate, dangerous all-around receiver that just happens to be built like a stick.
Yeah, it's impressive. And that was the one thing I would say about Carolina where I said maybe they won't be in the number one overall pick conversation was their playmakers. And you see DJ Moore, you see Robbie Anderson, what they're able to do. So impressed by what the Panthers are doing. We mentioned the Jags and the Texans. The Texans, they had, you know, you just change the coach. All of a sudden you win. It was closer than maybe people expected for a while. But Deshaun Watson made some plays, a little bad luck on some interceptions. But that offense, they found Brandon Cooks down the field, which I thought was huge. They started to use those guys, the speed down the field a little bit more, and I thought that helped.
All you got to do to right the ship is to fire the guy that was running everything and play a depleted Jacksonville Jaguars.
That's it. Completely resolved.
It's like, yeah, look, Houston looked better. On the other hand, they were playing a Jacksonville team that started off with maybe the least talented roster in the NFL and is depleted. Like, of course Brandon Cooks looked good. Look who was covering him. I mean, you know, come on. Let's have some awareness for who they were playing. Like, they didn't dominate a Jacksonville team that was wrecked with injuries and had nobody out there covering the fastest receiving group in the NFL. Of course they look good.
Hey, Sidney Jones was out there making plays for them.
Yeah, on a tip pass that landed in his gut.
He was making plays. Everyone else was not. Chris Claybrooks was playing cornerback.
Yeah,
Trey Herndon out there. Wasn't great.
No.
So I think Houston still has some issues.
Yeah, but... I mean, look. Great for them to get off the schneid, get a win. On the other hand, if you couldn't win this game, like, you're screwed. Like, if you couldn't win this game, we're talking about Houston being in the running for like a top draft pick, not how much can they right the season.
Man, just trying to bring some positive energy to my future Houston Texans.
No,
we'll right the ship. We'll right the ship. Our friend Seth Payne, a Houston media member, he's asking if Houston should be a seller at the trade deadline. I don't know what they would sell.
Right.
JJ?
Should they be a seller? That would be an interesting.
They don't have a draft pick until round three.
Yeah.
If you're trying to overhaul a roster.
Particularly the way he's been playing this year. Like, if you can convince some team that he's actually still a defensive player of the year kind of player, and really he's not, you can just go.
The problem with JJ is one of those face of the franchise.
Yes.
Everything he
but
did with the
you got Watson. You can get away with that.
No, I know. I get it. I'm just saying, like, I would be a seller for any draft capital.
If a team came along and waved a first round pick in your direction for JJ Watt, you would find it pretty hard to turn that down.
On the other hand, Houston has played the bulk of their difficult schedule.
It's still not easy.
They still have they still have Deshaun Watson. They're in the AFC South. How hard could that be? Colts just lost.
Yeah.
How hard could it be? Even with one win in week 5, saw the Colts come back from that a couple years ago. With Frank Reich's first year.
Tennessee are undefeated, and they may never play again if they all get COVID. So
if the playoffs ended today, Tennessee's they got a bye, right? Or no, there's only one bye now. 3-0 Tennessee. Anyway, speaking of how hard could it be, that is not what showed up on NFL Red Zone. But our friend Andrew Siciliano.
Friend of the show.
He summed up the Miami Dolphins win against the San Francisco 49ers perfectly.
Yeah.
Let's listen to Andrew. On Thursday, we talked to him about a little bit of an Easter egg. What could you do? What could you do for the PFF NFL podcast on NFL Red Zone? Here's what we said. We're going to figure something out. We're going to have some Easter eggs for the DirecTV listeners. I think that's what we're going to try to pull
off. You should. I will do it. And listeners to the podcast, if they're still listening at this point with all our rambling.
That's a great caveat. Great caveat.
They should give us suggestions.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So we'll get some suggestions from the listeners. We'll have something PFF NFL podcast related, or you could also just cite PFF grades as much as possible throughout the afternoon. You know, it's easy. Right.
Or we could make up like a fake metric.
Yes.
Oh, that's
now
really good.
We're cooking. We'll get a group text going. We'll have some serious, you know, ideation going.
Yeah, we're gonna do this.
The ridiculous things we could do. This is perfect.
I can't wait. I'm firing up Red Zone this week.
Like guard pull pancake percentage.
Yes. Please. Make sure all your spotters know to keep an eye out for the guard pull pancakes.
Yeah.
And we'll make that happen.
Particularly if it's like a wide receiver on the play.
Yeah. Totally. This is gonna be great.
Get out of the way.
2 years as the head coach.
So a resounding win for the Dolphins, 43-17. They go to 2-3, and as our friends of Pro Football Focus would say, they are creeping back towards average. So are the 49ers, for that matter, now at 2-3. And if you're wondering, yes, that is an advanced metric.
Thanks, Andrew. That's why he needs to be on the show more often. So we're going to send him something else for next week?
So we can get more things on TV?
Yes.
Awesome that he did that, by the way.
Yeah, he's
the man. Fantastic.
Go listen to the interview on Thursday if you didn't. It was a fun little discussion, a little inside TV stuff. Talk about Andrew, his process with NFL Red Zone. But the Dolphins destroy the 49ers.
This is my other, forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. Because when we were previewing this game, I was like, I don't understand why this line is only 9 points in San Francisco's favor. And I was like, oh, yeah, because they don't know who their quarterback is going to be, right? Nick Mullins had a disaster. C.J. Beathard, Jimmy Garoppolo is still working his way back from injury. It's like, honestly, it doesn't matter. Like, any of those three, they should be covering 9 points against the Dolphins. And they get absolutely wrecked because Jimmy Garoppolo, who should have been their best quarterback, goes out there and plays a disastrous game. And then they end up benching him for his own safety, claiming that, look, the ankle clearly wasn't 100%. Let's drag him back to the bench.
Kyle Shanahan was very much protecting him at the end of the game, saying, yeah, he was playing banged up. He doesn't normally throw the ball like that. It wasn't the same guy.
Yeah.
Remember when Garoppolo was coming back from his knee injury before last season? He had that Monday night game where he was like 1 for 5 with 2 picks. And that was after throwing 5 picks at training camp. And everybody's like, oh, Garoppolo's a mess. I mean, it felt like that playing in. He doesn't play injured very well, apparently.
Yeah.
Really
not well.
So I don't know how much you chalk that up to the injury, and you're like, hey, he's got another week to recover. He should be okay. But, yeah, that was concerning. Look, I expected some regression from the Niners this year. I wasn't expecting Miami and Fitz to whip it around the yard on them and absolutely dominate.
Jimmy Garoppolo, PFF grade in the 20s. C.J. Beathard comes in, and without a team playing prevent defense for a few drives, doesn't actually look very good. He struggles. And on the other end of the scale, you've got Ryan Fitzpatrick out there just dealing, notching himself another PFF grade in the 90s. Like, Fitzmagic is, dude, that guy's career is insane. He was crappy for a decent period of his career. And then late in his twilight years, grows out the giant badass beard and starts slinging around 90 grades with bad teams like it's nothing.
He wasn't crappy. He was gunslinger. Crappy. He was in the 20s. He ranked in the 20s.
Early in his career, he was crappy.
Now he's in the teens. He's played like a quarterback in the teens the last few years.
But with a bunch of 90-plus grades.
Oh, yeah. The high-end games are stupid. And we need to, yeah. He has more Foles-type games than, you know, we
than Foles
maybe,
does.
Yes. We maybe overrate the Foles game. I got to look that up. I'll look it up for the next pod. How many 90-plus or like 88-plus games has Fitz put up the last few games? Because that's, once you get into like 86, 88, that's pretty elite territory for a game grade for PFF. He's got a ton of them. There are just some games where he's on. Cornerback Brian Allen had a game to forget for the Niners. He just kept getting picked on.
So my analogy of, you know, Kyle Shanahan being Rembrandt, and it doesn't matter what you give him with, or it doesn't matter what you give him, he's able to create a masterpiece. Turns out that if you leave the masterpiece alone and unguarded, like a toddler can just walk in there and like stomp all over it and destroy it. That's what's happening right now, is that apparently he's found things that are bad enough that can destroy the masterpiece while he's not paying attention.
And the analogy continues. So rough one as the Dolphins, both teams creeping back toward average in different directions. Thank you, Andrew.
But Miami, like, if they get Fitzpatrick playing like that, they can do damage. Like, the defense is not amazing, but playing that level of man coverage is awkward.
Volatile.
Yeah, and it's awkward unless you have a phenomenal receiving core that you know will win like pretty much every rep, right? If you don't have that, it's not easy to play a team that's going to play aggressive man coverage constantly. And then if you're able to actually have a quarterback playing out of his mind on the other side of the ball, like, Miami isn't bad.
I love Xavien Howard's stat line. This is the most Xavien Howard season right now. He's got 5 games. He's got 3 coverage grades under 60. Mm-hmm. But he now has 2 grades over 84. Those are really good, including the interceptions. In his 2 best games, he hasn't given up a catch on 7 targets. So in his best game, Xavien Howard does look just like Richard Sherman. The problem is it really shows up 4, 5, 6 times a year. But I mean, it's just awesome. That's just what Xavien Howard is. He had one of his good games.
Yeah, the 49ers need their secondary healthy, which is their big problem. Like, Brian Allen was bad. Jamar Taylor was bad. Richard Sherman has been injured, isn't back yet. They just need those guys on the field.
Speaking of Richard Sherman, you can hear him every week on our friend Chris Collinsworth, his podcast. The Chris Collinsworth podcast, it features Richard Sherman every single week. Some of the best NFL football discussion, off-field discussion. I know you've been a big fan. Not that I haven't been, but you've been a big fan because you came into this anticipating. This is amazing. Chris and Sherman, two guys who love the game, see it differently, see it intelligently. So it's a pretty good mix.
Yep. The end. Yeah, it is. I agree. I concur. I endorse this message. I approve of this message.
That's all I wanted from you, is a little
approval.
So go check it out. Download and subscribe to Chris Collinsworth podcast. Again, we told Chris we'd help him get this thing off the ground. No, it's really good. It's really good. So go check it out. Anywhere you're listening to us or anywhere you listen to your podcast. All right, what else do we have here?
Alex Smith game.
Yes, that's what it was.
Dude,
great story,
Alex Smith,
man.
Came back.
I mean, that's
on
a story.
The field. That, dude, that, how, I've never really appreciated before because my kid is 7, but, you know, sending them out into harm's way on a regular basis and just looking at it like hoping they don't destroy anything. When you were watching Alex Smith play, it's like, oh, that's great. He's back on the field. Like, a round of applause for Alex Smith. What a great story. Comeback player of the year. Give it to him now. And then it's like Aaron Donald is jumping on his back. God,
like,
stop.
His second drop back.
Dude, his first sack was literally giving Alex Smith a piggyback, or giving Aaron Donald a piggyback.
Yeah.
Like, that guy barely had a leg a while ago, and now you're carrying an extra 285 pounds on your back.
Yeah. It was uncomfortable because I know his leg isn't what it was. It's, you know, back and healthy, but man, it felt like, I just don't want Alex to take a hit.
Yeah. And the weird thing is, so Kyle Allen goes down with a head, gets smacked in the head, apparently passes whatever like concussion protocols or HIA in rugby head injury assessment, passes whatever was required to pass to get medically cleared to go back out. But it was a coaching decision to keep Alex Smith out there. And Alex Smith was getting murdered. He had got sacked six times. Aaron Donald is just in his lap every 2 seconds. Like, at some point, I mean, Alex Smith may be better equipped to protect himself than Kyle Allen is. On the other hand, he also had 17 surgeries on his leg and might have less of himself to protect than Kyle Allen.
Yeah, and well, Alex was never really the best at – he had a quick release, but he always took way more sacks than he should have as a game manager, so that was always a part of it. And then how much has he actually practiced? How much? How many reps has he gotten in camp? Because Dwayne Haskins has been the starter. Kyle Allen has been the backup. They didn't have preseason games. Like, how many live-action plays has Alex Smith actually had since coming back from injury?
Average depth of target this week, the bottom two are both the Washington football team. Alex Smith, 5.8, and Kyle Allen with 2.0 average depth of target.
It was a rain game trying to protect those guys.
It was ugly, whatever was going to happen, but God, it felt uncomfortable watching Alex Smith out there.
So the Rams take care of business. They go to 4-0 in the NFC East.
Yeah.
And just, wow, what a story. Alex Smith coming back and playing football. Looks like Kyle Allen will be back as the starter.
Jared Goff is playing quietly really well.
They were given a ton of Kevin O'Connell's the offensive coordinator there, and they were giving him a ton of credit during the broadcast. And when we've talked about the McVay offense in the next iteration, Kevin O'Connell is one of the guys that probably deserves credit here. Yeah. And it's just been
also Zach
Robinson, obviously, who moved out of the QB room this year.
Damn it!
But to the receiver room. And those are guys are getting open.
Yes.
So, Zach, exactly. Good job. I would still put Zach on defense. Uh-huh. But I think that's part of it, too. It's not like Goff's not making amazing throws either. We talked about Roethlisberger having six big-time throws. Goff only has a handful. This offense is just – they're rolling, though. Like, it's just an efficient brand of football that they're playing right now, and they're putting Goff in position to succeed. He's one of the lowest in the league at avoiding negatively graded plays.
He's a weird force multiplier to an offense that's working really well, though. Because I think, like, when you get an offense that is firing on all cylinders, Goff has this bizarre ability to actually add an insane amount of value with plays that some quarterbacks don't. But then when it starts to falter and stumble, he looks terrible.
Yeah, but I think they're doing a really good job with him this year. So
yeah.
They've also played 4 games against the NFC East, 4-0 Rams. Let's wrap it up with 2 more games. The Cincinnati Bengals, this is my confession.
Okay.
I said they're unblowoutable.
Yeah.
They're blowoutable.
They were blown out.
They were blown out by the Baltimore Ravens. I want to say this, though. The Ravens still don't feel right. They just don't feel – they're not even close to what they were last year from a dominant – offense standpoint. Lamar Jackson did not play well at all yesterday. I know there's rain and all that stuff, but just from a pure decision-making standpoint, poor. 3 turnover-worthy plays. They threw the ball twice as much as they ran the ball until about garbage time. It just isn't the same offense that they were last year. Now, it would be tough to duplicate them having the 6th best. If their run game was a pass game, it'd be the 6th most efficient pass game. Like that, duplicating that was going to be tough. Still just doesn't feel right for Baltimore. But you got that 2000 Ravens defense that you expected to come back.
this was, poor Joe Burrow. Like, he'd been playing with fire for a while.
Yeah.
You know, taking hits that he shouldn't take against not great defenses. This was what we feared might happen, right? You go up against a Baltimore defense that confuses the living crap out of young quarterbacks and can get after you and cause you problems, and it just wrecked poor Joe Burrow. Like, the dude didn't know when he was coming or going. Took some bad sacks, like a sack 7 times or something. Like, it just, this is ugly.
Rain aside, because it did get rainy there, just like it did in Washington, wasn't making good throws or decisions. It was also hilarious because draft time, we always talk about hand size. We had 9-inch hand Joe Burrow and 9-inch hand Jared Goff both playing in the rain. Goff had one pass where he looked like he was straight pie throwing. It looked Rivers like he was just, it actually got there. So I'm going to go back and rewatch the tape for the 9-inch hand guys.
We don't all have freaky foot wide hands like you.
I can throw.
Your hands are so absurd you can't grip a football properly. I can throw. Discovered at the start of this video, if you're watching on YouTube.
Don't assess my grip. A lot of buzz around our hometown of Cincinnati that AJ Green is upset. He was upset on the interception, and he said, "Trade me." And people are reading his lips. We might need to get our friend Paul Daner on here to unlock.
Oh, not to read lips.
Okay. No, not to read lips. Just to unlock the real story with AJ Green. But either way, I view coming into the season, I said, "Look, give him a few weeks with Joe Burrow. You're probably not going to compete. Maybe you will, but ultimately, AJ Green's best value to the Bengals is probably as a trade piece." And with so many receiving cores and just so many injuries around the league, do you want to grab another injured player? But the upside of AJ Green for a contender right now is huge.
Is it?
To be on the trading block.
I don't know that anybody wants any part of AJ Green.
I think the upside of it is great.
But he looks done. That's his problem. He's getting upset because he's not a big part of this offense. But the reason you're not a big part of this offense is because you can't get open anymore.
Hmm.
I mean,
but I think he's a complementary part of another offense where he doesn't have to be the number one. And he's a red zone threat and, you know, contested catch guy in this time at this point in his career.
I'm not sure you're going to have too many trade suitors if you're trying to ship him off.
Arizona and the Jets are the last game, but are we underappreciating Larry Fitzgerald at this point in his career? So many other receivers that are not named Jerry Rice just can't make it past 33, 34, 35 years old.
Yeah.
And Fitz isn't great right now, but he's still playing and efficient.
The key to that is being able to transition inside, right? Where you get the free releases, you just have to find the space that's given to you, right? Because that's what playing in the slot often is. It's like, I can't actually beat anybody anymore. But on the other hand, if it's a zone defense, I know where the soft spot is. I can sit in space and wait for the ball to arrive. And I have great hands like Larry Fitzgerald. I'm never going to drop one. So I can be functional and still keep chugging along with that 600-700 yards a season. That's how you catch a Jerry Rice. It's not the 1,500-yard seasons you have to be concerned about. It's the last 500-700-yard seasons that you need to assemble.
So anyway, ugly game for the Bengals. Baltimore, still want to see. They still haven't played their complete game. I'll leave it at that. With the Ravens, and we'll wrap it up with the Cardinals and the Jets. Probably the most unexciting game of the year, of the week. But the other teams that are winless are at least showing signs of life. The Jets are not. They're getting destroyed every week. Joe Flacco out there, great in the 50s, and Cardinals offense looked good against a bad Jets defense.
Yeah, which about sums up this game. Like, the question we had going in, and basically the only question is, can the fact that the Jets are able to stop the run aggressively up front impact what the Cardinals do and mess with Kyler Murray in the way that the game before did? The answer was no. Kyler Murray and the Cardinals offense was able to roll. Joe Flacco and the Jets offense was not. The Jets are just a mess. This team is on track for the number one overall pick. Other teams are in contention, but nobody is like committing to it the way the Jets are in terms of just depressing, awful play. Any bright sparks they have been injured. Like, it's they're
or have been Jamison Crowder. He is the bright spot there for the Jets. He pretty much was their entire offense with over 100 yards on 9 targets. So yeah, not great for the New York Jets.
No,
that'll do it, man. Is that everything? Do we forget anything?
I don't think so. If we did, it's your fault because you did the document.
If we did, you'll get into the YouTube comments and give your analysis. So that's it. Week 5, we still have Monday Night Football, Chargers Saints. We have a full preview on the YouTube channel, plus the
Tuesday Night Football, right?
And Tuesday Night Football with the Bills and Titans. Those previews are in our preview podcast, so go ahead and listen to that if you missed it originally. But Week 5, mostly in the books. We'll be back here Thursday. Do we have Will Brinson this week? Is that what I saw?
I believe so, yeah.
Will Brinson from CBS Sports, I think, will be our special guest. I'll check my calendar, but I'm pretty sure we got some pretty good guests lined up.
Mm.
We'll see if he can give us some sort of Easter egg drop somewhere, too.
Future Hall of Famers on the way?
We do?
Yeah.
Yeah, we do. Oh, wow. So check it out. PFF NFL Podcast, bringing in the guests in the coming weeks. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. We'll see you on Thursday for the Week 6 preview.